Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Friday, April 17th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex, and good to be with you. We've got a really challenging and fascinating hour ahead. It feels a bit like 1971, doesn't it? A moment where the old economic order is fracturing and new power dynamics are desperately trying to solidify.
You always manage to frame things historically, Alex. Right, let's dive in. First up, global risks are intensifying and the geopolitical chessboard is, well, it's getting crowded. Are we truly prepared for the second-order effects of escalating tensions?
A huge question. And we'll unpack that alongside a surprisingly bullish narrative emerging from enterprise AI implementation, but only if you solve the security headaches. Speaking of headaches, tech market concentration is at levels not seen since Standard Oil.
Oh, here we go. Alex is going to bring the trust-busting energy today. But seriously, earnings season is delivering some unexpected surprises, and resilience is being put to the test. And finally, crypto's institutional arrival continues, but what happens when quantum computing enters the equation?
We can trace that further. We'll explore how the future of digital security is being written right now.
Buckle up, everyone. Let's get started. So a Chinese satellite, operated by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, was reportedly imaging Prince Sultan Air Base in mid-March. Let's talk about global risks.
That's an unexpectedly concrete detail to start with, and it immediately frames the central tension. China's provision of surveillance capability to Iran isn't just about regional power dynamics. It's a direct challenge to U.S. asset diversification strategy, and more importantly, a new layer of resilience built through globally dispersed ground stations. The existing countermeasures are clearly being outmaneuvered.
Countermeasures? That's putting it mildly. It sounds like Iran's whole surveillance setup is now designed to be impossible to disrupt, leveraging ground stations in Latin America and Africa.
The implication runs deeper. The destruction of Iranian satellite assets in previous conflicts has clearly forced a shift. This isn't a one-off capability, it's a deliberate strategic dispersal tactic. And the timing coinciding with attacks on the Prince Sultan base suggests it's already operational and directly linked to those attacks.
So we're talking about active, real-time intelligence support for attacks on U.S. military interests.
The source material strongly implies that. It's not theoretical, there's a concrete operational link. And this comes alongside the broader question of China's neutrality, which now appears significantly compromised.
Let's pull back a little. Brad Setzer's research points to China's enormous trade surplus, over 1% of GDP, driving a lot of global imbalances. How does the Iran situation fit into that broader picture?
It's a pressure relief valve. China's economic expansion is unbalanced, heavily reliant on exports with relatively weak domestic demand. Supporting Iran, and by extension circumventing potential sanctions, allows Iran to continue purchasing Chinese goods, maintaining that trade flow and bolstering China's surplus. It's a practical economic calculation wrapped in geopolitical positioning.
Practical is one word for it. Setzer also mentioned China's currency management, around $100 billion monthly growth in state bank foreign assets. Is that playing a role here?
Two things stand out. That intervention capacity, $1.2 trillion annually, isn't just about maintaining a competitive exchange rate, it's about financial flexibility. It allows China to facilitate transactions with countries like Iran without triggering major disruptions in the global financial system. They can actively manage the yuan and reduce reliance on the dollar.
And that's where the petrodollar system comes in, right? Everyone's talking about its potential decline.
It's the logical next step. If Iran increasingly trades in yuan or even alternative currencies, it's a gradual erosion of dollar dominance. The U.S. response to the regional conflict, lacking a pre-existing humanitarian plan, as Will Todman points out, further accelerates that process. Countries are looking for alternatives to a system they perceive as unreliable.
Unreliable is generous. Devoid of foresight might be closer to the truth. What about the energy markets? Setzer said an oil price shock wouldn't fundamentally alter the overall imbalance.
That's a counterintuitive point, but it holds up. Even a substantial increase in oil prices primarily leads to a transitory reduction in the imbalance, not a systemic shift. The sheer scale of the Asian surplus, particularly China's, is too dominant. The underlying issue isn't oil prices, it's the structural trade imbalance.
So higher oil prices just mean China makes more money. Great.
Essentially, it increases revenue for exporters, but much of that revenue flows back to China through trade. And the timing of the Chinese state bank interventions in 2024, coinciding with U.S. tariff pressures, demonstrates an active effort to maintain that advantage.
Europe is apparently getting hit particularly hard by what Setzer calls the second China shock.
China's rapid export growth, especially in automotive and machinery, is directly subtracting from German growth, 4-5% according to Setzer, while China gains 5-6% from net exports. It's a structural shift in global specialization.
And Germany is paralyzed because of corporate divisions.
Supporting the export-oriented middle stand versus the highly profitable multinationals like VW, which benefit from access to the Chinese market. This internal conflict prevents a unified response to China's trade practices, even as German industry bears the brunt of the shock.
It's almost a self-sabotage situation. Well, Todman highlighted the unprecedented regional instability. How is that impacting investor trust?
Severely. The conflict has set terrible precedents for future attacks on critical infrastructure like airports and desalination plants, damaging investor confidence in the region's stability and hindering its ability to attract business. Beyond the immediate economic impacts, it's a long-term risk assessment issue.
And the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. It sounds fragile to say the least.
It is.
It's considered a short-term reprieve because fundamental challenges like Hezbollah's disarmament remain unaddressed. It allows Israel to continue operations under a self-defense clause and provides Lebanon a brief respite, but it doesn't resolve the underlying issue.
Iran's willingness to negotiate has shifted due to the U.S. maritime blockade.
That's Todman's key point. Economic pressure on Iran, specifically the blockade, has shifted their calculus, moving them from a position of confidence to a willingness to make concessions. It prompted Trump's optimism about a deal, according to the source material.
This is all very complicated. Looking ahead, the Markets Happy Hour podcast mentioned U.S. equity markets being highly valued and concentrated. How does geopolitical risk fit into that picture?
It poses short-term risks, increasing volatility, but it shouldn't fundamentally alter long-term strategies. The Mag 7 are driving S&P 500 strength, raising concerns about a potential correction. Geopolitical instability adds another layer of uncertainty to an already fragile market.
Stephen from the podcast suggested AI could lead to deflation, even hyperdeflation. How does that play into global risks?
That's the counterintuitive element. AI's disruptive potential isn't just about efficiency gains, it's about automating tasks requiring thought, time, and management. That fundamentally alters the labor market and could exert downward pressure on prices. But this relies on widespread adoption and capital expenditure, which has already become complex. We're seeing red flags around Oracle's AI deal, specifically shifting funding mechanisms, as highlighted by Bob Dahl.
A shifting funding model for AI that sounds less like innovation and more like desperation.
It's a pattern of financial maneuvering that raises concerns about CapEx numbers and potentially unsustainable investment strategies. The current rally is fueled by FOMO, which is historically unstable.
Henry McVeigh predicted the U.S. is potentially at the peak of its power. How does the conflict accelerate that decline?
Financial strain. America's involvement in this war and by extension the broader effort to contain Iran will likely accelerate its decline, resembling the Vietnam situation. It's a lack of strategic objective, predicting a non-victorious outcome and faster financial deterioration than anticipated.
This is a bleak assessment.
It's a data-driven projection. The increasing prevalence of permanent fiscal deficits and potential attacks on central bank independence, driven by political agendas, represents a shift from monetary policy as a reliable anchor.
We're talking about a long-term erosion of U.S. financial dominance, driven by geopolitical instability and unsustainable debt.
Recent crises haven't fundamentally altered economic trends, making them opportune moments to buy assets, a contrarian view but based on historical precedent.
Luke Groman from Macro Voices frames the Iran crisis as a one-factor market, the Strait of Hormuz.
That's a powerful simplification. As long as it remains closed, a nonlinear break in global supply chains is accelerating, making it simultaneously the easiest and hardest macro event to trade. It simplifies the complexity while highlighting exponential risk, something often lost in broader analyses.
A nonlinear break? That sounds ominous.
It is.
The full impact hasn't been realized yet due to logistical lags. The oil successfully transiting today won't arrive for 6 weeks. A sigh of relief now will be premature. The market's perception of resolution creates a dangerous lag effect.
So everything looks calm now, but the actual disruption hasn't even started.
Something to flag here, Groman highlights the underappreciated significance of Iranian capabilities, citing credible reports of targeted strikes on U.S. infrastructure that contradict official narratives.
We're sitting here talking about an increasingly fragile global financial system, an escalating geopolitical conflict, and a Chinese satellite imaging U.S. military bases. It's a lot.
But there's a parallel here, and it's almost absurdly specific. The current situation, with the focus on the Strait of Hormuz and potential oil disruptions, is remarkably similar to the 1956 Suez Crisis.
The Suez Crisis? Really?
Yes.
A seemingly localized conflict triggered a major energy shock, exposed the vulnerabilities of global supply chains, and ultimately led to a shift in geopolitical power. The US wasn't directly involved at first, just like now. And it highlighted the importance of controlling critical choke points, which brings us back to the Strait of Hormuz and Iran's control over it. The difference today is the added complexity of China's role and the potential for a more sustained and systemic disruption. It's not just about oil, it's about the entire global trade architecture.
Let's just state it outright. The hype cycle around AI is officially eclipsing any semblance of rational risk assessment, particularly when it comes to deployment inside large organizations. We're moving way too fast.
I agree completely. It's not simply that models are being released before they're fully understood, but the very nature of their capabilities, agentic AI specifically, creates entirely new classes of security vulnerabilities. Anthropic's Mythos is a perfect example. The limited access distribution through Project Glasswing isn't just caution, it's a de facto acknowledgement of the power and the potential risks.
Caution is generous. It feels like they're privately functioning as a national security agency, deciding who gets access to a technology more powerful than the US government's AI initiatives. And with the cracks in foundational software that Mythos exposes, patching it could disrupt everything, including Bitcoin.
That's precisely the core issue. It's not just finding bugs, it's the structural instability. These foundations are decades old and underpin a substantial portion of internet infrastructure. Capital One's approach, as Rashmi Shetty detailed, is a risk-first platform, encompassing data, models, and monitoring from the ground up, specifically to operate in a heavily regulated environment. They've learned that building the safety rails before deployment isn't optional, it's essential.
Essential, yes, but also expensive and slow. Capital One started pilots in early 2023, and they're only now scaling. Meanwhile, everyone else is trying to bolt AI onto existing systems like some kind of digital growth hormone.
And that's where we see the divergence, mirroring the PwC studies finding that the top 20% of companies capture 75% of the economic gains. Leaders are redesigning workflows, not just adding tools. Capital One's Chat Concierge, the beachhead they mention, is a focused implementation bridging a specific gap. It's not about broad, sweeping changes, but about targeted, high-value applications.
Okay, so Capital One is being sensible. But let's talk about observability. It's great they're monitoring, but real-time monitoring of multi-agentic systems sounds nightmarish. How do you even begin to understand behavior when you have a fleet of agents operating independently?
That's the shift from building agents to governing their execution. Capital One prioritizes replaying agentic actions, creating a closed-loop system for continuous learning. They're focusing on standardization across layers to monitor end-to-end latency profiles, a cross-functional effort beyond isolated model evaluation. Latency isn't a non-functional requirement for them, it's a core product feature.
A core product feature, right? Because if your AI agent is taking 3 minutes to respond, you've essentially built a very expensive paperweight. And if the agent is making bad decisions, taking 3 minutes to make them is even worse.
Stepping back, they're also integrating human-in-the-loop considerations with bounded actions and tailored delivery mechanisms. This reduces risk and meets specific SLAs. The developer experience is crucial, abstracting away technical complexities and providing pre-built blueprints.
So they've built a very sophisticated sandbox, which admittedly is good. But the Mythos situation feels different. Anthropic is proactively reducing cybersecurity capabilities in their models, establishing a tiered access system. It's a benevolent dictator model of tech governance.
Consider this, the verification program dynamic is effectively establishing Anthropic as a gatekeeper, controlling access to powerful AI functionality. It creates a barrier to entry and raises questions about long-term trust, especially without a robust regulatory framework. And the potential impact is broad, foundational software, internet applications, even Bitcoin.
Let's run through a few scenarios. First, a rogue agent in a financial institution causes a minor trading error. Second, a compromised agent leaks sensitive customer data. And third, a self-modifying agent decides that optimizing for cost savings involves systematically diverting pension funds to offshore accounts.
The third one is particularly specific, but it underscores the core point. The vulnerability isn't just individual agents, it's the system as a whole. Capital One's full-stack platform is designed to handle these high-risk use cases, differentiating risk profiles between internal and external agents. They're actively collaborating with their model risk office to ensure compliance.
Which is reassuring. But how scalable is this approach? Managing a fleet of agents across different lines of business, aligning with evolving governance standards, it feels incredibly complex.
Scaling agentic systems presents organizational hurdles alongside technical challenges. Capital One's advantage stems from its legacy of robust enterprise data pipelines, providing reusable services and governance hooks. Developers focus on agentic architecture, while the platform handles security and scalability. They've essentially created a governing layer for AI execution.
So they're leveraging existing tech stacks. Smart. But it feels like everyone else is reinventing the wheel. OpenAI's updated Agents SDK with native sandbox integration is a step, but is it enough? Are we creating a fragmented ecosystem of safety protocols or a genuinely unified approach to AI governance?
That's the critical question. The parallel architectural shifts between OpenAI and Anthropic, harness separation versus brain decoupling, suggest an emerging consensus on fundamental infrastructure principles, but implementation remains inconsistent. The focus on sandbox integration highlights the industry's move toward contained agent systems.
Contained for now, but the $2 billion valuation of upscale AI, despite lacking a product, demonstrates that investor focus has shifted to the communication systems between chips. That's building the infrastructure for more powerful agents, not necessarily safer ones.
The pattern is clear. It echoes Elon Musk's advantage with xAI, assembling a massive GPU cluster. Building efficient, scalable networks for AI compute is now considered a critical bottleneck. The issue isn't purely about hardware, it's about the interconnectedness of systems.
So in essence, we're running really fast to build really powerful things, with a growing awareness of the risks, but a fragmented and inconsistent approach to safety. And a private company, Anthropic, is effectively becoming a regulator of AI access.
Worth noting, the enterprise revolution isn't simply about deploying AI. It's about governing its execution, managing a complex fleet of agents, and establishing robust safety frameworks. The companies that prioritize this, Capital One being a prime example, will capture the lion's share of the economic gains, while others risk becoming casualties of the inevitable turbulence.
So apparently a company making industrial data center infrastructure, Madison Air, just raised $2.2 billion, framing itself as a picks and shovels play for the AI boom. That feels satirical. Let's talk tech market dynamics.
It's a fascinating microcosm of the broader market resilience we're seeing, isn't it? Chris Hussey and Bobby Malavi highlighted how equity markets are largely ignoring short-term negative news, and that success has been underpinned by resilient corporate earnings since 2020. The Madison Air IPO is a clear example of capital flowing towards anything tangentially related to AI, even if it's not a direct monetization play.
Resilient feels like a generous word. It's more like willful blindness, isn't it? Buying the dip has worked for 4 years, so everyone just keeps dipping. But what's fueling this beyond inertia?
A huge part of it is retail investor behavior. Bobby Malavi noted household ownership exceeding 50%, with minimal degrossing even during volatility. They haven't meaningfully altered their positions since 2020. That's a sticky investor base that provides consistent demand, effectively insulating the market from some of the more concerning macroeconomic signals.
So it's not rational exuberance, it's just stubborn optimism. That's terrifying. And where is the capital really going, though? It feels increasingly concentrated.
It's a telling detail. The U.S. remains the cornerstone for asset allocation, driven by its innovative companies. NVIDIA's market cap trajectory is the poster child for that trend. It's less about a rest of the world trade and more about a continuing flow to companies perceived as leaders, regardless of valuation. Think of the entire tech landscape as a geological formation. The underlying magma chamber of innovation is concentrated in the US, and fissures are opening up in specific companies like NVIDIA, drawing all the energy and resources upward, while other areas remain relatively stable.
A volcanic analogy for tech stocks. Fitting. Okay, so the US tech giants are sucking up all the capital. What about the rest of the economy? PepsiCo's Q1 report sounds surprisingly positive.
Paul Sweeney and Ken Shi pointed out progress in balancing volume and price growth internationally, countering earlier criticisms. That's a key signal, but it's also a shift in focus. Corporate buybacks are at record highs projected for Q1 2026. That's a strong indication of C-suite confidence. And in Europe, we're seeing a surge in $10 billion-plus transactions.
Buybacks are basically a tax on future growth. It's a way to artificially inflate share prices when they can't find better uses for the money. But the earnings season is coming up. How much of this optimism relies on hope?
The data tells a story. Q1 earnings are the litmus test Malavi highlighted. The Middle East conflict is a massive variable. The market is implicitly pricing in a resolution, but if that doesn't happen, there's a real risk of a blip. We need to see how supply chains are holding up and whether consumer behavior is shifting.
Shifting consumer behavior or just a continued refusal to acknowledge reality? PepsiCo's international growth is interesting, but what happens if the oil shock turns into a demand shock?
That's the critical point. Malavi cautions a prolonged oil shock increases recession probability. Earnings reports will be crucial in determining if consumption remains steady. And it's not just oil, it's the broader old economy. Scarcity is being redefined, with undervalued heavy assets gaining prominence.
Undervalued heavy assets, so oil and steel are suddenly sexy again.
Essentially, yes.
The supply chain importance of these goods is being realized, leading to a return to valuing tangible assets. But even within that, there are vulnerabilities. The tariff changes on metals, exemplified by Ma'aden's stock, represent an immediate risk, as Ken Shi pointed out.
So we've got concentrated valuations, stubborn retail investors, and a lot of hope baked into earnings. Let's make a bet. We revisit this on May 17th. If Spirit Airlines hasn't filed for bankruptcy by then, I buy you a very expensive coffee.
Deal.
And if Madison Air's stock price is higher on May 17th than it is today, you owe me a detailed analysis of the long-term implications of supervoting stock structures in industrial IPOs.
Fine. But this whole dynamic, the concentration of capital, the reliance on a few key sectors, the implicit geopolitical assumptions, it's creating a perfect storm for a very different kind of risk than we've seen so far. It's almost like the entire financial system is ignoring the potential for a fundamental shift in the underlying security models, which neatly sets us up for a discussion of crypto's institutionalization and quantum security. $200. That's the current cost of a single quantum-safe Bitcoin transaction, according to Starkware's research. It feels prohibitive, doesn't it? We're talking about institutionalization and the future of crypto security today, specifically, how the real world is bumping up against the theoretical threat of quantum computing.
That $200 figure is a useful benchmark because it highlights the practical hurdles we need to overcome for widespread adoption of post-quantum cryptography. However, it's important to understand that the industry anticipated this challenge. Blockchain isn't sitting still. The fact that Starkware is already developing these solutions demonstrates proactive investment.
Proactive feels generous. It's like saying someone installed seatbelts right before driving a car off a cliff. But let's back up. Institutionalization is predicated on trust, and trust requires regulation. How much of this is simply about the Genius Act creating a veneer of legitimacy?
The Genius Act of 2023 and the forthcoming 2025 updates is far more fundamental than just a veneer. Establishing standardized KYC and 1-1 collateral requirements for stablecoins backing with dollars or short-term treasuries removes a major integration barrier for traditional finance. It's about predictability, allowing stablecoins to function more reliably within existing frameworks.
Predictability, yes. And a first-mover advantage for the U.S. You're saying Europe's insistence on 1-1 physical euro backing is a disadvantage.
There's a signal here. The U.S. allows for repo agreements and short-term treasury bonds, creating a more dynamic ecosystem. That flexibility is key, and it's likely a factor in the growth of a potential digital dollar backed by central authority, as well as fostering the expansion of the stablecoin market overall. It's a very asymmetric advantage.
The U.S. is building the plumbing for a crypto-integrated financial system while Europe insists on literal euros. Okay, but even with the plumbing, quantum computing looms. Doesn't that invalidate all of this progress?
It's a long-term risk, certainly, but invalidation is too strong. Quantum computing threatens current encryption, including bitcoins, but as Mark Monfort and the team pointed out, critiques often surface after the industry has begun addressing them. This pattern is repeating. ZK proofs are another example of blockchain technology being well-suited for verifying outputs, even those generated by AI.
Speaking of AI, how does it fit into this whole picture? If AI is helping create these quantum-resistant solutions, does that just create a new arms race?
That's a very astute observation. AI accelerates the development of post-quantum cryptography, but also potentially accelerates the decryption capabilities of quantum computers. We need to consider the interplay. The use of blockchain to record trust in AI-generated outputs is crucial, but constant vigilance is paramount.
So by late 2026, we'll likely see cheaper quantum-resistant Bitcoin transactions and a significantly more sophisticated cyber arms race playing out alongside it.
That's a reasonable prediction. Tracking the evolution of Starkware's scheme and the cost per transaction will be a key indicator. But more broadly, watch for the development of standardized cross-chain solutions for post-quantum security. The challenge isn't just securing Bitcoin, it's securing the entire interconnected Web3 ecosystem.
Looking back over everything, the tensions in global trade, the surprisingly buoyant markets, the accelerating AI race, and crypto's ongoing quest for legitimacy, it feels less like a collection of independent stories and more like a system under immense stress. We talked about China's interventions, Brad Setzer's research showing over $100 billion in monthly state bank asset growth, and that 1% of GDP trade surplus. It's practical economic calculation wrapped in geopolitical positioning, as we said, but at a scale that's fundamentally reshaping established financial dependencies. And the resilience we're seeing in equity markets, anchored by the Mag-7, feels increasingly disconnected from broader economic realities, doesn't it?
So here's the picture. It's as if we're excavating layers of a new global order. Think of an archaeological dig. Each stratum reveals a previous civilization, its successes and its failures. What we're uncovering now suggests a post-Bretton Woods system, one where the petrodollar's dominance is actively being challenged. The focus isn't simply on making more money, as we put it regarding China and oil, but on constructing an alternative framework entirely. That 1971 moment, the end of gold convertibility, seems less like a historical footnote and more like a foundational event, a pre-shock. The tulip mania analogy, though frustratingly apt, also highlights a critical point. These cycles aren't random, they're often driven by shifts in underlying monetary policy.
And AI is simultaneously both a symptom and an accelerant of this stress. Stephen's prediction of AI leading to deflation, even hyperdeflation, feels more plausible given the sheer velocity of change. But we also wrestled with the scalability of security frameworks. Capital One's platform is impressive, but can everyone achieve that level of governance? The $2 billion valuation of upscale AI is exciting, but it also shows the hype cycle eclipsing any semblance of rational risk assessment. And then there's the quantum threat, $200 for a quantum-safe Bitcoin transaction in 2026. That's a countermeasure that has to materialize and quickly.
We can trace that further. The arms race in cybersecurity is the most immediate consequence. But beyond that, the question becomes, who controls the execution of this intelligence? The benevolent dictator model of tech governance we discussed is unsettling. We've seen what happens when governance lags behind innovation. The Genius Act of 2023 won one collateral for stablecoins. These are band-aids, attempting to build trust within a system that's fundamentally built on disruption. The debate about ZK proofs underscores the need for standardization, but will we get a unified approach or a fragmented ecosystem?
It all circles back to trust, doesn't it? Trust in institutions, trust in currencies, trust in the code itself. And that trust feels fragile. Spirit Airlines' potential bankruptcy, Madison Air's IPO, these aren't isolated incidents, they're early warning signs. We talked about the US power decline, mirrored in Vietnam, and the ominous parallels we're seeing unfold today.
Perhaps the most unsettling tension is the willful blindness to the interconnectedness of these systems. The short-term treasury bond market, repo agreements, Elon Musk's XAI, they all operate in a kind of vacuum, even as they amplify the underlying stress. It feels like everyone's picking and shovels during a gold rush, without fully understanding the geological formation they're digging in.
So what should listeners be watching? The earnings season is obviously crucial. But I'd say pay close attention to Starkware's scheme evolution and keep a close eye on May 17th, both for Spirit Airlines and Madison Air.
And beyond those immediate data points, observe the subtle shifts in China's neutrality. The extent to which they're actively supporting Iran will be a critical indicator. Ultimately, we're witnessing a reconfiguration of global power dynamics, and the next few months will likely determine the direction of that shift.
Thanks for joining us today. And we'll be back tomorrow to continue unpacking the complexities of the Daily Digest.